NSA to task one of its computer weenies to do the cracking. That would mean faking a request by CIA to do the job, and that, the accountant figured, was a little harder to accomplish than just typing a note into a computer terminal. He also suspected that the campus had someone inside both intelligence agencies who could do the faking so that no discernible paper trail would be left behind. Is it strictly necessary? Maybe in a week or so I can find more data. This Solly guy might just be a rich kid playing stickball out in the traffic, but my nose tells me he's a player of some sort, Cunningham admitted. He'd developed good instincts over the years, as a result of which two former mafia kingpins were now living in solitary cells at Marion, Illinois. But he didn't trust his own instincts as well as his former and current superiors did. A career accountant with a foxhound's nose, he was also very conservative in talking about it. A week, you think? Dave nodded. About that. How's the Ryan kid? Good instincts. He found something most people would have missed. Maybe his youth works for him. Young target, young bloodhound. Usually it doesn't work. This time, looks like maybe it did. You know, when his dad appointed Pat Martin to be Attorney General, I heard some things about Big Jack. Pat really liked him, and I worked with Mr. Martin enough to respect him a lot. This kid may be going places. It'll take about 10 years to be sure of that, of course. We're not supposed to believe in breeding over here, Dave, Tom Davis observed. Numbers is numbers, Mr. Davis. Some people have a good nose, some don't. He doesn't yet, not really, but he's sure heading that way. Cunningham had helped start the Justice Department's Special Accounting Unit, which specialized in tracking terrorist money. Everyone needed money to operate, and money always left a trail somewhere, but it was often found after the fact more easily than before. Good for investigations, but not as good for active defense. Thanks, Dave, Henley said in dismissal. Keep us posted, if you would. Yes, sir. Cunningham gathered his papers and made his way out. You know, he'd be a little more effective if he had a personality, Davis said 15 seconds after the door closed. Nobody's perfect, Tom. He's the best guy they ever had at Justice for this sort of thing. I bet when he fishes, there's nothing left in the lake after he leaves. No argument here, Jerry. So, this Solly gent might be a banker for the bad guys? It looks like a possibility. Langley and Fort Meade are still in a dither over the current situation, Henley went on. I've seen the paperwork. It's a whole lot of paper for not much hard data. In the business of intelligence analysis, you get into the speculation phase too rapidly. The point when experienced analysts started applying fear to existing data, following it to God knew where, trying to read the minds of people who didn't speak all that much, even to each other. Might there be people out there with anthrax or smallpox in little bottles in their shaving kits? How the hell could you tell? That had been done once to America, but when you get down to it, everything had been done once to America. And while it had given the country the confidence that her people could deal with damn near anything, it had also given Americans the realization that bad things could indeed happen here, and that those responsible might not always be identifiable. The new president did not convey any assurance that we'd be able to stop or punish such people. That was a major problem, in and of itself. You know, we're a victim of our own success, the former senator said quietly. We've managed to handle every nation-state that ever crossed us, but these invisible bastards who work for their vision of God are harder to identify and track. God is omnipresent, so are his perverted agents. Jerry, my boy, if it was easy, we wouldn't be here. Tom, thank God I can always count on you for moral support. We live in an imperfect world, you know. There isn't always enough rain to make the corn grow, and if there is, sometimes the rivers flood. My father taught me that. I always meant to ask you, how the hell did your family ever end up in goddamn Nebraska? My great-grandfather was a soldier. cavalrymen, 9th Cavalry, Black Regiment. He didn't feel like moving back to Georgia when his hitch ran out. He'd spent some time at Fort Crook outside of Omaha, and the dumbass didn't mind the winters. So we bought a spread near Seneca and farmed corn. That's how history started for us Davises. Wasn't any Ku Klux Klan in Nebraska? No, they stayed in Indiana. Smaller farms there, anyway. My great-grandfather shot himself some buffalo when he got started. There's the biggest damn head over the fireplace at home. Damn thing still smells. Dad and my brother mainly hunt longhorn antelope now. A speed goat, they call it at home. Never got to like the taste. What's your nose say on this new intel, Tom? Hendley asked. I'm not planning to go to New York anytime soon, buddy. East of Knoxville, the road divided. I-40 went east, I-81 went north. And the rented Ford took the latter. Through the mountains explored by Daniel Boone, when the western frontier of America had scarcely stretched out of sight of the Atlantic Ocean, a road sign showed the exit for the home of someone named Davy Crockett. Whoever that was, Abdullah thought, driving downhill through a pretty mountain pass. Finally, at a town named Bristol, they were in Virginia, their final major territorial boundary. About 6 more hours, he calculated. The land here in the sunlight was lush in its greenness, with horse and dairy farms on both sides of the road. Even churches, usually white-painted wooden buildings with crosses atop the steeples. Christians. The country was clearly dominated by them. Unbelievers. Enemies. Targets. They had their guns in the trunk to deal with them. First, I-81 north to I-64. They'd long since memorized their routing. The other three teams were surely in place now. Des Moines, Colorado Springs, and Sacramento. Each a city large enough to have at least one good shopping mall. Two were provincial capitals. None were major cities, however. All were what they called Middle America, where the good people lived, where the ordinary, hard-working Americans made their homes, where they felt safe, far from the great centers of power and corruption. Few, if any, Jews to be found in those cities. Oh, maybe a few. Jews like to run jewelry stores. Maybe even in the shopping malls. That would be an added bonus. But only something to be scooped up if it accidentally offered itself. Their real objective was to kill ordinary Americans, the ones who considered themselves safe in the womb of ordinary America. They would soon learn that safety in this world was an illusion. They'd learn that the thunderbolt of Allah reached everywhere.
So, this is it? Tom Davis asked.
Yes, it is. Dr. Pasternak replied. Be careful. It's fully loaded. The red tag, you see. The blue one is not charged.
What does it deliver?
Succinylcholine, a muscle relaxant. Essentially a synthetic and more potent form of curare. It shuts down all the muscles, including the diaphragm. You can't breathe, speak, or move. You're fully awake. It'll be a miserable death. The physician added in a cold, distant voice.
Why is that? Henley asked.
You can't breathe. Your heart rapidly goes into anoxia, essentially a massive induced heart attack. It won't feel very good at all.
Then what?
Well, the onset of symptoms would take about 60 seconds, 30 seconds more for the full effects of the drug to present themselves. The victim would collapse then, say, 90 seconds after the injection. Breathing stops completely about the same time. The heart is starved for oxygen. It will try to beat, but it's not delivering any oxygen to the body or to itself. Heart tissue will die in about 2 or 3 minutes, and will be extremely painful as it does so. Unconsciousness will happen at about the 3-minute mark, unless the victim had been exercising beforehand. In that case, the brain will be highly infused with oxygen. Ordinarily, the brain has about 3 minutes' worth of oxygen in it to function without additional oxygen infusion, but at about the 3 minute mark, after onset of symptoms, that is, 4.5 minutes after being stuck, the victim will lose consciousness. Complete brain death will take another 3 minutes or so. After that, the succinylcholine will metabolize in the body, even after death. Not entirely, but enough so that only a really sharp pathologist will pick it up on a toxicology scan, and then only if he's prepped to look for it. The only real trick is to get your test subject in the buttocks.
"Why there?" Davis asked.
"The drug works just fine with an IM intramuscular injection. When people are posted, it's always face up so that you can see and remove the organs. They rarely turn the body over. Now, this injection system does leave a mark, but it's hard to spot under the best of circumstances, and then only if you're looking at the right area. Even drug addicts, that will be one of the things they check for, don't inject themselves in the rump. It will appear to be an unexplained heart attack. Those happen every day. Rare, but not at all unknown. Tachycardia can make it happen, for example. The injector pen is a modified insulin pen like the kind type 1 diabetics use. Your mechanics did a great job of disguising it. You can even write with it, but if you rotate the barrel, it swaps out the pen part for the insulin part. A gas charge in the back of the barrel injects the transfer agent. The victim will probably notice it, like a bee sting, but less painful. But inside a minute and a half, he won't be telling anybody about it. His most likely reaction will be a minor ouch and then rub the spot, if that much, like a mosquito bite on the neck. You might slap at it, but you don't call the police." Davis held the safe blue pen. It was a little bulky, like a third grader might use on his first introduction to a ballpoint pen, after using thick barrel pencils and crayons for a couple of years. "So, as you approached your subject, you took it out of your coat pocket and swung it in a reverse stabbing motion and just kept going. Your backup hitter would watch the subject fall to the sidewalk, maybe even stop to render assistance, then watch the bastard die and get up and go on his way. Well, maybe call an ambulance so that his body could get sent to the hospital and be properly dismantled under medical supervision."
"Tom?"
"I like it, Jerry," Davis replied. "Doc, how confident are you about this stuff dissipating after the subject goes down for the count?"
"Confident," Dr. Pasternak answered.
And both of his hosts remembered that he was professor of anesthesiology at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. He probably knew his stuff. Besides, they'd trusted him enough to let him in on the secrets of the campus. It was a little late to stop trusting him now. "It's just basic biochemistry. Succinylcholine is made up of two acetylcholine molecules. Esterases in the body break the chemical down into acetylcholine fairly rapidly, so it is very likely to be undetectable, even by someone up at Columbia Presbyterian. The only hard part, to have done it covertly. If you could bring him into a doctor's office, for example, it would just be a matter of infusing potassium chloride that would put the heart into fibrillation. When cells die, they give off potassium anyway, and so the relative increase would not be noticed. But the IV mark would be hard to hide. There are a lot of ways to do this. I just had to pick one that is applied relatively conveniently by fairly unskilled people. As a practical matter, a really good pathologist might not be able to determine the exact cause of death. And he would know that he didn't know, and that would bother him. But that's only if the body is examined by a really talented guy. Not too many of them around. I mean, the best guy up at Columbia is Rich Richards. He really hates not knowing something. He's a real intellectual, a problem solver, and genius biochemist in addition to being a superb physician. I asked him about this, and he told me it would be extremely difficult to detect even if he had a heads-up on what to look for. Ordinarily, extraneous factors come into play. The specific biochemistry of the victim's body, what he's had to eat or drink, ambient temperature would be a huge factor. On a cold winter day, outside, the esterases might not be able to break down the succinylcholine because of a diminution of chemical processes.
So, don't do a guy in Moscow in January, Henley asked.
This deep science stuff was troublesome for him, but Pasternak knew his stuff. The professor smiled, cruelly. Correct. Also Minneapolis.
Miserable death? Davis asked.
He nodded. Decidedly unpleasant.
Reversible?
Pasternak shook his head. Once the succinylcholine is in the bloodstream, there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, theoretically, you could put the guy on a ventilator and breathe for him until the drug metabolizes. I've seen that done with Pavulon in an OR, but that would be a stretch.
Theoretically possible to survive, but very, very unlikely. People have survived being shot right between the eyes, gentlemen, but it's not exactly common.
How hard do you have to hit your target? Davis asked.
Not very, just a good poke. Enough to penetrate his clothing. A thick coat might be a problem because of the length of the needle, but ordinary business wear? No problem.
Is anyone immune to the drug? Henley asked.
Not to this one, no. That would be one in a billion.
No chance he'd make noise?
As I explained, it's like a bee sting at most. More than a mosquito, but not enough to make a man cry out in pain. At most, you'd expect for the victim to be puzzled, maybe to turn around and see what caused it. But your agent will be walking away normally, not running. Under those conditions, without a target to yell at, and since the initial discomfort is transitory, the most likely reaction is to rub the spot and walk on. For about, 10 yards or so.
So, rapid-acting, lethal, and undetectable. Right?
All of the above, Dr. Pasternak agreed.
How do you reload it? Davis required.
Damn. How has CIA not developed something this good? He wondered. Or KGB, for that matter.
You unscrew the barrel like this, he demonstrated, and take it apart. You use an ordinary syringe to inject a new supply of the drug and swap out the gas charge. These little gas capsules are the only hard part to manufacture. You toss the used one into a trash can or the gutter. They're only 4 millimeters long and 2 millimeters wide, and reinsert the fresh one. When you screw in the replacement, a little spike in the back of the barrel punctures it and recharges the system. The gas capsules are coated with sticky stuff to make them harder to drop. And just that fast, the blue one was hot, except for the absence of succinylcholine.
You want to be careful with the syringe, of course, but you'd have to be pretty stupid to stick yourself. If you cover your man as a diabetic, you can explain away the presence of syringes. There's an ID card to get insulin refills that works just about anywhere in the world, and diabetes has no outward symptoms.
Damn, Doc, Tom Davis observed. Anything else you could deliver this way?
Botulism toxin is similarly lethal. It's a neurotoxin, it blocks nerve transmissions, and it causes death by asphyxia, also fairly rapidly, but it's readily detectable in the blood during a post and kind of hard to explain away. It's available fairly readily around the world, but in microgram doses because of its use in cosmetic surgery.
Docs shoot women in the face with that, don't they?
Only the dumb ones, Pasternak replied. It takes wrinkles away, sure, but since it kills the nerves in the face, it also takes away your ability to smile much. That's not my field, exactly. There are a lot of toxic and lethal chemicals. It's the combination of rapid action and difficult detectability that made this a problem. Another quick way to kill someone is to use a small knife at the back of the skull, where the spinal cord enters the base of the brain. The trick is getting right behind your victim and then hitting a fairly small target with the knife and not having the knife jam between the vertebrae. At that range, why not a silenced .22 pistol? It's fast enough, but it leaves something behind. This method can easily be misdiagnosed as a heart attack. It's just about perfect, the physician concluded, in a voice sufficiently cold as to sprinkle snow on the carpet.
Richard, Henley said, you have earned your fee on this one.
The professor of anesthesiology stood, checking his watch. No fee, Senator. This one's for my little brother. Let me know if you need me for anything else. I have a train to catch back to New York.
Jesus, Tom Davis said after he left. I always knew docs had to have evil thoughts.
Henley picked up a package on his desk. There were a total of 10 pens in it, with computer-printed instructions for this use, a plastic bag full of gas capsules, and 20 large vials of succinylcholine, plus a bunch of throwaway syringes.
He and his brother must have been pretty close.
Know him? Davis asked.
Yeah, I did. Good guy. Wife and 3 kids. Name was Bernard. Harvard Business School graduate, smart guy, very astute trader. Worked on the 97th floor of Tower 1. Left a lot of money behind. Anyway, his family's well taken care of. That's something.
Rich is a nice guy to have on our side, Davis thought aloud, suppressing the shiver that came along with the opinion.
That he is, Jerry agreed.
The drive ought to have been pleasant. The weather was fair and clear, the road not at all crowded, and mostly straight northeast. But it was not pleasant. Mustafa kept getting, how far now, and are we there yet, from Rafi and Zuhair in the back seat, to the point that more than once he considered pulling the car over and strangling them. Maybe it was hard sitting in the back seat, but he had to drive this goddamn car. Tension. He was feeling it, and they probably were too, so he took a deep breath and commanded himself to be calm. The end of their journey was hardly 4 hours away, and what was that compared to their transcontinental trek? Certainly it was farther than the Holy Prophet ever walked or rode from Mecca to Medina and back. But he stopped that thought at once. He had no standing to compare himself with Muhammad, did he? No, you do not. One thing he was sure of. On getting to his destination, he was going to bathe and sleep just as long as he could. 4 hours to rest was what he kept saying to himself, as Abdullah slept in the right front seat. The campus had its own cafeteria, whose food was catered from a variety of outside sources. Today it was from a Baltimore deli called Atman's, whose corned beef was pretty good, if not quite New York class. Saying that might result in a fist fight, he thought, as he picked up a corned beef on a Kaiser roll. What to drink? If he was having a New York lunch, then cream soda, but Utz, the local potato chips, of course, because they'd even had them in the White House at his father's insistence. They probably had something from Boston there now. It was not exactly a renowned restaurant town, but every city has at least one good eatery, even Washington, D.C. Tony Wills, his normal luncheon mate, was nowhere to be seen. So he looked around and spotted Dave Cunningham, not surprisingly eating alone. Jack headed that way. Hey, Dave, mind if I sit down? He asked.
Take a seat, Cunningham said, cordially enough.
How's the numbers business?
Exciting, was the implausible reply.
Then he elaborated, you know, the access we have into those European banks is amazing. If the Department of Justice had this sort of access, they'd really clean up.
Except you can't introduce this kind of evidence into a court of law.
Yeah, Dave, the Constitution can really be a drag, and all those damn civil rights laws. Cunningham nearly choked on his egg salad on white.
Don't you start. The FBI runs a lot of operations that are a little shady.
usually because some informant lays stuff on us, maybe because somebody asked, or maybe not, and they spin that off. But within the rules of criminal procedure, usually it's just a plea bargain. There are not enough crooked lawyers to handle all of their needs. The mafia guys, I mean. I know Pat Martin. Dad thinks a lot of him. He's honest and very, very smart. He really ought to be a judge. That's where honest lawyers belong. Doesn't pay very much. Jack's official salary at the campus was well above anything any federal employee made. Not bad for entry level. That is a problem. But there's nothing all that admirable about poverty, my dad says. He toyed with the idea of zeroing out salaries for elected officials so that they'd have to know what real work was, but he eventually decided that it would make them even more susceptible to bribery. The accountant picked up on that. You know, Jack, it's amazing how little you need to bribe a member of Congress. Makes the bribes hard to identify, the CPA groused, like being down in the weeds for an aircraft. What about our terrorist friends? Some of them like a comfortable life. A lot of them come from moneyed families, and they like their luxuries. Like Solly. Dave nodded. He has expensive tastes. His car costs a lot of money. Very impractical. The mileage it gets must be awful, especially in a city like London. The gas prices over there are pretty steep. But mainly he takes cabs. He can afford it. It probably makes sense. Parking a car in the financial district must be costly, too. And the cabs in London are good. He looked up. You know that. You've been to London a lot. Some, Jack agreed. Nice city. Nice people. He didn't have to add that a protective detail of Secret Service agents and local cops didn't hurt much. Any further thoughts on our friend Solly? I need to go over the data more closely, but like I said, he sure acts like a player. If he was a New York Mafia subject, I'd figure him for an apprentice consigliere. Jack nearly gagged on his cream soda. That high up? Golden rule, Jack. He who has the gold makes the rules. Solly has access to a ton of money. His family's richer than you appreciate. We're talking $4 or $5 billion here. That much? Ryan was surprised. Take another look at the money accounts he's learning to manage. He hasn't played with as much as 15% of it. His father probably limits what he's allowed to do. He's in the capital preservation business, remember? The guy who owns the money, his father, won't hand him the whole pile to play with, regardless of his educational background. In the money business, it's what you learn after you hang your degrees on the wall that really matters. The boy shows promise, but he's still following his zipper everywhere he goes. That's not an unusual thing for a rich young kid, but if you have a few gigabucks in your wallet, you want to keep your boy on a leash. Besides, what he appears to be funding, well, what we suspect he's funding isn't really capital-intensive. You spotted some trades on the margins. That was pretty smart. Did you notice that when he flies home to Saudi, he charters a GV? No, Jack admitted. I didn't look into that. I just figured he flies first class everywhere. He does. Same way you and your father used to. Real first class. Jack, nothing is too small to check out. What do you think of his credit card usage? Entirely routine. But that's noteworthy even so. He could charge anything if he wanted to, but he seems to pay cash for a lot of expenditures. And he spends less cash than he converts to his own use, like with those hookers. The Saudis don't care about that, so he's paying cash there because he wants to, not because he has to. He's trying to keep some parts of his life covert for reasons not immediately apparent. Maybe just practice. I would not be surprised to find out that he's got more credit cards than the ones we know about. Unused accounts. I'd be rifling through his bank accounts later today. He doesn't really know about how to be covert yet. Too young, too inexperienced, no formal training, but... Yes,
I think he's a player, hoping to move into the big leagues pretty soon. The young and rich are not known for their patience, Cunningham concluded. I should have guessed that myself, Junior told himself. I need to think this stuff through better. Another important lesson, nothing too small to be checked out. What sort of guy are we dealing with? How does he see the world? How does he want to change the world? His father had always told him how important it was to look at the world through the eyes of your adversary, to crawl inside his brain, and then look out at the world. Solly is a guy driven by his passions in women, but was there more to it? Was he hiring the hookers because they were good screws, or because he was screwing the enemy? The Islamic world thought of America and the UK as essentially the same enemy. Same language, same arrogance, damn sure the same military, since the Brits and Americans cooperated so closely on so many things. That was worth considering. Make no assumptions without looking out through his eyeballs. Not a bad lesson for one lunchtime. Roanoke slid off to their right. Both sides of I-81 were composed of rolling green hills, mostly farms, many of them dairy farms, judging from all the cows. Green highway signs telling of roads that, for his purpose, led nowhere. And more of the white-painted boxy churches. They passed school buses, but no police cars. He'd heard that some American states put highway police in ordinary-looking cars, one's not very different from his own, but probably with additional radio antennas. He wondered if the drivers wore cowboy hats here. That'd be decidedly out of place, even in an area with so many cows. The cow. The second surah of the Quran, he thought. If Allah tells you to slaughter a cow, you must slaughter it without asking too many questions. Not an old cow, nor a young one, just a cow pleasing to the Lord. Were not all sacrifices pleasing to Allah, so long as they were not sacrifices founded in conceit? Surely they were, if offered in the humility of the faithful. For Allah welcomed and was pleased by the offerings of the truly faithful. Yes. And he and his friends would make more sacrifices by slaughtering the unbelievers. Yes. Then he saw a sign for Interstate Highway 64, but it was to the west, the wrong one. They had to go east, to cross the eastern mountains. Mustafa closed his eyes and remembered the map he'd looked at so many times. North for about an hour, then east. Yes. Brian, those shoes are going to come apart in the next few days.
Hey, Dom. I ran my first 4.5-minute mile in these, the Marine objected.
You remembered and treasured such moments.
Maybe so, but next time you try that, they're going to come apart and beat the shit out of your ankle.
Think so? Bet a buck you're wrong. You're on, Dominic said at once. They shook hands formally on the wager.
They look pretty scruffy to me, too, Alexander observed. You want me to buy new T-shirts, too, Mom?
They'll self-destruct in another month, Dominic thought aloud.
Oh, yeah? Well, I outshot your ass with my Beretta this morning.
Luck happens, Enzo sniffed. See if you can make it 2 in a row.
I'll put $5 on that.
Deal. Another handshake.
I could get rich this way, Dominic said.
Then it was time to think about dinner. Veal piccata tonight. He had a thing for good veal, and the local stores had nice stuff. Pity about the calf, but he hadn't been the one to cut its throat. There, I-64, next exit. Mustafa was tired enough that he might have given the driving over to Abdullah, but he wanted to finish himself, and he figured he could handle another hour. They were heading for a pass in the next range of mountains. Traffic was heavy, but in the other direction. They climbed up the highway toward, yes, there it was, a shallow mountain pass with a hotel on the south side, and then out onto a vista of a most pleasant valley to the south. A sign proclaimed its name,
but the letters were too confusing for him to get them into his head as a coherent word. He did take in the view off to his right. Paradise itself could scarcely have been more lovely. There was even a place to pull over, get out, and take in the sight. But of course they had not the time. It was fitting that the drive was gently downhill, and it changed his mood entirely, less than an hour to go. One more smoke to celebrate the timing. In the back, Rafi and Zuhair were awake again, taking in the scenery. It would be their last such opportunity. One day of rest and reconnaissance, time to coordinate via email with their three other teams, and then they could accomplish their mission. That would be followed by Allah's own embrace. A very happy thought. Chapter 13. Meeting Place. After 2,000-plus miles of driving, the arrival was entirely anticlimactic. Not a kilometer off Interstate 64 was a Holiday Inn Express, which looked satisfactory, especially since there was a Roy Rogers immediately next door and a Dunkin' Donuts not 100 meters uphill. Mustafa walked in and took 2 connecting rooms, paying with his Visa card out of the Liechtenstein Bank. Tomorrow they'd go exploring, but for now all that beckoned was sleep. Even food was not important at this moment. He moved the car to the first-floor rooms he'd just leased and switched off the engine. Rafi and Zuhair unlocked the doors, then came back to open the trunk. They took their few bags in, and under them the 4 submachine guns still wrapped in thick, cheap blankets. "We are here, comrades," Mustafa announced, entering the room. It was an entirely ordinary motel, not one of the more luxurious hotels they'd become accustomed to. They had 1 bathroom and a small TV each. The connecting door was opened. Mustafa allowed himself to fall backward on his bed, a double, but all for him. Some things were left to be done, however. "Comrades, the guns must always be hidden, and the shades drawn at all times. We've come too far for foolish risks," he warned them. "This city has a police force, and do not think they are fools. We journey to paradise at a time of our choosing, not at a time determined by an era. Remember that." And then he sat up and removed his shoes. He thought about a shower, but he was too tired for that, and tomorrow would come soon enough. "Which way to Mecca?" Rafi asked. Mustafa had to think about that for a second. Divining the direct line to Mecca and to the city's centerpiece, the Kaaba stone, the very center of the Islamic universe, to which they directed the Salat, verses from the Holy Quran said 5 times per day, recited from the knees. "That way," he said, pointing southeast, on a line that transected northern Africa on its way to that holiest of holy places. Rafi unrolled his prayer rug and went to his knees. He was late in his prayers, but he had not forgotten his religious duty. For his own part, Mustafa whispered to himself, "Lest it be forgotten," in the hope that Allah would forgive him in his current state of fatigue. But was not Allah infinitely merciful? And besides, this was hardly a great sin. Mustafa removed his socks and lay back in the bed where sleep found him in less than a minute. In the next room over, Abdullah finished his own salat, and then plugged his computer into the side of the telephone. He dialed up an 800 number and heard the warbling screech as his computer linked up with the network. In the next room over, Abdullah finished his own salat, and then plugged his computer into the side of the telephone. He dialed up an 800 number and heard the warbling screech as his computer linked up with the network. In another few seconds, he learned that he had mail. 3 letters, plus the usual trash. The emails he downloaded and saved, and then he logged off, having been online a mere 15 seconds, another security measure they'd all been briefed on. What Abdullah didn't know was that 1 of the 4 accounts had been intercepted and partially decrypted by the National Security Agency. When his account, identified only by a partial word and some numbers, tapped into Saeed's. It was also identified, but only as a recipient, not an originator. Saeed's team had been the first to arrive at its destination of Colorado Springs, Colorado. The city was identified only by a code name, and was comfortably camped out in a motel 10 kilometers from its objective. Sabawi, the Iraqi, was in Des Moines, Iowa, and Mehdi in Provo, Utah. Both of those teams were also in place and ready for the operation to commence, less than 36 hours to execute their mission. He'd let Mustafa do the replies. The reply was, in fact, already programmed, 190, 2, designating the 190th verse of the second surah. Not exactly a battle cry, but rather an affirmation of the faith that had brought them here. The meaning was, proceed with your mission. Brian and Dominic were watching the History Channel on their cable system, something about Hitler and the Holocaust. It had been studied so much you'd think it'd defy efforts to find something new. Yet somehow historians managed every so often. Some of it was partly because of the voluminous records the Germans had left behind in the Hartz Mountain Caves, which would probably be the subject of scholarly study for the next few centuries, as people continued to try to discern the thought processes of the human monsters who'd first envisioned and then committed such crimes. Brian? Dominic asked. What do you make of this stuff? One pistol shot could have prevented it, I suppose. Problem is, nobody can see that far into the future, not even gypsy fortune tellers. Hell, Adolf whacked a bunch of them, too. Why didn't they get the hell out of town? You know, Hitler lived most of his life with only one bodyguard. In Berlin, he lived in a second-floor apartment with a downstairs entrance, right? He had one SS troop, probably not even a sergeant, guarding the door. Pop him, open the door, go upstairs, and waste the motherfucker. Would have saved a lot of lives, bro, Dominic concluded, reaching for his white wine. Damn. You sure about that? The Secret Service teaches that. They send one of their instructors down to Quantico to lecture every class on security issues. The fact surprised us, too. A lot of questions on it. The guy said you could walk right past the SS guard on your way to the liquor store, like. Easy hit, man. Easier in hell. The thinking is that Adolf thought he was immortal. That there wasn't a bullet anywhere with his name on it. Hey, we had a president whacked on a train platform waiting for his train to arrive. Which one was it? Chester Arthur, I think. McKinley got shot by a guy who walked right up to him with a bandage around his hand. I guess people were a little careless back then. Damn. It'd make our job a lot easier. But I'd still prefer a rifle from 500 meters or so. No sense of adventure, Aldo? Ain't nobody paying me enough money to play kamikaze, Enzo. No future in that, you know? What about those suicide bombers over in the Mideast? Different culture, man. Don't you remember from second grade? You can't commit suicide because it's a mortal sin, and you can't go to confession after. Sister Frances Mary made that pretty clear, I thought. Dominic laughed. Damn. Haven't thought of her in a while. But she always thought you were the cat's ass. That's because I didn't screw around in class like you did. What about in the Marines? Screwing around? The sergeants took care of that before it came to my attention. Nobody messed with Gunny Sullivan, not even Colonel Winston. He looked at the TV for another minute or so. You know, Enzo, maybe there are times when one bullet can prevent a lot of grief. That Hitler needed his ticket punched. But even trained military officers couldn't bring it off. The guy who placed the bomb just assumed that everybody in the building had to be dead without going back inside to make sure. They say it every day in the FBI Academy, bro. Assumptions are the mother of all fuck-ups. You want to make sure, yeah. Anything worth shooting is worth shooting twice. Amen, Dominic agreed. It had gotten to the point that Jack Ryan Jr. woke up to the morning news on NPR expecting to hear about something dreadful. He guessed that came from seeing so much raw intelligence information, but without the judgment to know what was hot and what was not. But though he did not know all that much, what he did know was more than a little worrying. He'd become fixated by Uda bin Sali. Probably because Sali was the only player he knew much about. And that had to be because Sali was his personal case study. He had to figure this bird out, because if he didn't, he'd be encouraged to seek other employment. He hadn't seen that possibility until now, which by itself did not speak well for his future in the spook business. Of course, his father had taken a long time to find something he was good at. 9 years, in fact, after graduating Boston College, and he himself had not yet lived one whole year past his Georgetown sheepskin. So, would he make the grade at the campus? He was about the youngest person there. Even the secretary pool was composed of women older than he was. Damn, that was an entirely new thought. Sali was a test for him, and probably a very important one. Did that mean that Tony Wills already had Sali figured out, and he was off chasing data already fully analyzed? Or did it mean that he had to make his case and sell it after he'd reached his own conclusions? It was a big thought for standing in front of the bathroom mirror with his Norelco. This wasn't school anymore. A failing grade here meant failing life? No, not that bad. But not good, either. Something to think about with coffee and CNN in the kitchen. For breakfast, Zuhair walked up the hill, where he purchased 2 dozen donuts and 4 large coffees. America was such a crazy country. So many natural riches, trees, rivers, magnificent roads, incredible prosperity, but all in the service of idolaters. And here he was, drinking their coffee and eating their donuts. Truly the world was mad, and if it ran on any plan at all, it was Allah's own plan, and not something even for the faithful to understand. They just had to obey that which was written. On returning to the motel, he found both TVs tuned into the news, CNN, the global news network, the Jewish-oriented one, that is. Such a pity that no Americans watched Al Jazeera, which at least tried to speak to Arabs, though, to his eyes, it had already caught the American disease. Food, Zuhair announced, and drink. 1 box of donuts went into his room, and the other to Mustafa, still rubbing the sleep from his eyes after 11 hours of snoring slumber. How did you sleep, my brother? Abdullah asked the team leader. It was a blessed experience, but my legs are still stiff. His hand shot out for the large cup of coffee, and he snatched a maple-frosted donut from the box, downing half of it in 1 monstrous bite. He rubbed his eyes and looked at the TV to see what was happening in the world this day. The Israeli police had shot and killed another holy martyr before he'd been able to trigger his bodysuit of Semtex. Dumb fuck, Brian observed. How hard can it be to pull a string? I wonder how the Israelis twigged to him. You gotta figure they have paid informants inside that Hamas bunch. This has got to be a code-worded major case for their police. Lots of resources assigned, plus help from their spook shops. They torture people, too, don't they? Dominic nodded after a second's consideration. Yeah. Supposedly it's controlled by their court system and all that, but they interrogate a little more vigorously than we do. Does it work? We talked that one around at the academy. You put a Bowie knife to somebody's dick, chances are he'll see the wisdom of singing, but it's not something anybody wanted to think much about. I mean, yeah, in the abstract it can even seem funny, but doing it yourself, probably not very palatable, you know? The other question is, how much good information does it really generate? The guy's just as likely to say anything to get the knife away from his little friend, make the pain stop, whatever. Crooks can be really good liars unless you know more than they do. Anyway, we can't do it. You know, the Constitution and all that. You can threaten them with bad jail time and scream at them, but even then there are lines you can't cross. They sing anyway? Mostly. Interrogation's an art form. Some guys are really good at it. I never really had much of a chance to learn it, but I did see some guys play the game. The real trick is to develop a rapport with the mutt, saying stuff like, "Yeah, that nasty little girl really asked for it, didn't she?" Makes you want to puke afterward, but the name of the game is getting the bastard to fess up. After he gets into the joint, his neighbors will hassle him a lot worse than I ever would. One thing you don't want to be in prison is a child abuser. I believe it, Enzo. That friend of yours in Alabama, maybe you did him a favor. Depends on if you believe in hell or not, Dominic responded. He had his own thoughts about that. Wills was early this morning. Jack saw him on his workstation when he came in. You beat me in for once. My wife's car came back from the shop. Now she can take the kids to school for a change, he explained. Check the feed from Meade, he directed. Jack lit up his computer, sat through the startup procedures, and typed in his personal encryption code to access the interagency traffic download file from the downstairs computer room. The top of the electronic pile was a flash priority dispatch from NSA Fort Meade to CIA and FBI and Homeland Security, one of whom would surely have briefed the president on it this morning. Strangely, there was almost nothing to it. Just a numeric message. A set of numbers. So? Junior asked. So it might be a passage from the Quran. The Quran has 114 surahs, chapters, with a variable number of verses. If this is such a reference, it's a verse with nothing particularly dramatic in it. Scroll down and see for yourself. Jack clicked his mouse. That's all? Woods nodded. That's all. But the thinking at Meade is that such a dull message is likely to denote something else, something important. Spooks tend to use a lot of reverse English when they hit the cue ball. Well, duh. You're telling me that because it appears to have no importance to it, it may be important? Hell, Tony, you can make that observation about anything. What else do they know? The network, where the guy logged on from, that sort of thing. It's a European network, privately owned, with 800 numbers all over the world, and we know some bad guys have used it. You can't tell where the members log in from. Okay, so first, we do not know if the message has any significance. Second, we do not know where the message originated. Third, we do not have any way of knowing who's read it or where the hell they are. The short version is that we don't know shit, but everybody's getting in a flutter about it. What else? The originator? What do we know about him? He, or she, for all we know, is thought to be a possible player. What team? Guess. The NSA profilers say that this guy's syntax seems to indicate Arabic as a first language, based on previous traffic. The shrinks at CIA agree. They have copied messages from this bird before. He says nasty things to nasty people on occasion, and they're time-linked with some other very bad things. Is it possible that he's making some signal related to the bomber the Israeli police bagged earlier today? Possible, yes, but not terribly likely. The originator isn't linked to Hamas, as far as we know. But we really don't know, do we? Well, these guys, you can't be totally sure about anything. So we're back to where we started. Some people are running around over something they really don't know shit about. That's the problem. In these bureaucracies, it's better to cry wolf and be wrong than to have your mouth shut when the big gray critter runs off with a sheep in his mouth. Ryan sat back in his chair. Tony, how many years were you at Langley? A few. Wills answered. How the hell did you stand it? The senior analyst shrugged. Sometimes I wonder. Jack turned back to his computer to scan the rest of the morning's message traffic. He decided to see if Solly had been doing anything unusual over the last few days, just to cover his own ass. And in thinking that, John Patrick Ryan Jr. started thinking like a bureaucrat, without even knowing it. "Tomorrow it's going to be a little different," Pete told the twins. "Michelle is your target, but this time she'll be disguised. Your mission is to ID her and track her to her destination. Oh, did I tell you? She's really good at disguises." "She's going to take an invisible pill, right?" Brian asked. "That's her mission," Alexander elucidated. "You're going to issue us magic glasses to see through the makeup?" "Not even if we had any, which we don't." "Some pal you are," Dominic observed coldly. By 11 that morning, it was time to scout the objective. Conveniently located just a quarter mile north on U.S. Route 29, the Charlottesville Fashion Square Mall was a medium-sized shopping mall that catered to a largely upscale clientele of local gentry and students at the nearby University of Virginia. It was anchored by a JCPenney at one end and a Sears at the other, with Belk's men's and women's stores in the middle. Unexpectedly, there was no food court, per se. Whoever had done the reconnaissance had been sloppy. A disappointment, but not all that uncommon. The advance teams the organization employed were often mere stringers, for whom missions of this sort were something of a lark. But Mustafa saw on going in, it would do little harm. A central courtyard opened into all four of the mall's main corridors. An information stand even supplied diagrams of the mall showing store locations. Mustafa looked one over. A six-pointed Star of David leaped off the page at his eyes. A synagogue here? Was that possible? He walked down to see, halfway hoping that it was indeed possible. But it wasn't. It was, rather, the mall's security office, where sat a male employee in a uniform of light blue shirt and dark blue pants. On inspection, the man did not have a gun belt, and that was good. He did have a phone, which would undoubtedly call the local police, so this black man would have to be the first. With that decided, Mustafa reversed directions, walked past the restrooms and the Coke machine, and turned right, away from the men's store. This was a fine target place, he saw. Only three main entrances and a clear field of fire from the central court. The individual stores were mainly rectangular, with open access from the corridors. On the following day, at about this time, it would be even more crowded. He estimated 200 people in his immediate sight, and though he'd hoped all the way into this city that they'd have the chance to kill perhaps 1,000, anything over 200 would be a victory of no small dimension. There were all manner of stores here, and unlike Saudi malls, men and women shopped on the same floor. Many children, too. There were four stores listed as specialty children's goods, and even a Disney store. That he had not expected, and to attack one of America's most treasured icons would be sweet indeed. Raffi appeared at his side. Well, it could be a larger target, but the arrangement is nearly perfect for us. All on one level, Mustafa replied quietly.
Allah is beneficent as always, my friend, Raffi said, unable to conceal his enthusiasm.
People circulated about. Many young women were pushing their little ones about in strollers. He saw that you could rent them from a stand just by the hair salon. There was one purchase he had to make. He accomplished it in the radio shack next to Azale's Jewelers, four portable radios and batteries, for which he paid in cash, and for which he got a brief lecture on how the radios worked. All in all, it could have been better, in a theoretical sense, but it wasn't supposed to be a busy city street. Besides, there would be policemen on the street with guns who would interfere with their mission. So, as always in life, you measured the bitter against the sweet, and here there was much of the sweet for all of them to taste. The four of them all got pretzels from Auntie Anne's and headed out past the JCPenney back to their car. Formal planning would take place at their motel rooms, with more donuts and coffee. Jerry Rounds's official job was as head of strategic planning.